Jason Mead, sub for Natural Resources, to order. And I'd like to open the public hearing for the House Bill 5035, the Land Use Board of Appeals. To start with, Sue, would you give us an oversight?
I certainly will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've distributed several handouts for you today, three from LFO, and then there, actually four, I'm sorry, and then there's a handout from the Budget and Management Division, and then there's also a bound document, and that is LEMA's presentation, and they'll be using that to do their portion. But for now, I'd just like to give you a brief overview of the budget. There's an orientation and background sheet that you should have from LFO, and I'm just going to go through these numbered items, which are the issues that we are to cover in our orientation and introduction. And the first one, number one, refers you to an attached handout, which talks about the agency's mission and purpose, which they'll also cover, so I won't read that to you. And the reverse side of that handout has a pie chart which shows you that most, about 95% of LUBA's budget is from the general fund, supported by the general fund, and a small portion from other funds, which are from the sales of LUBA reports. And those funds help pay for part of a publications coordinator position and also for the cost of publishing those LUBA reports. And then finally, the last box on the second page of that document just shows you what the budget drivers are for LUBA, and they'll be talking about those as well. The next handout I've provided to you is our more detailed analysis that usually is in a one large document that you get at the beginning of every session that has an analysis like this on each agency, but because of the timing of the governor's budget, we're trying to get these out to you individually as each agency's budget hearing comes up. Anyway, this goes into a little bit more detail about the program and its revenue sources and relationships, the budget environment, including the drivers again. And probably the one thing that I would like to point out to you in this document is on the reverse side of it, there, about in the middle of the page, there is a discussion about what has happened to this budget as a result of the special session actions and what is now going to happen to this budget as a result of the failure of Measure 28. And the agency, again, can go over that in more detail when they do the presentation. And then there's a short description on what's included in the governor's recommended budget. And then the last handout that I've provided for you is some information that I got off the internet on the state of Washington. It has a kind of a similar setup, but it has three of these hearing boards instead of one. Their boards are regional in nature, and this just gives you some information on the budget for those boards, the number of FTE staffing the boards, and then just some kind of in a question and answer format what the board does. And you can maybe see some similarities but also some differences in what these regional boards do in Washington versus what LUBA does here in Oregon. But that's in keeping with the co-chair's request to have some state-by-state comparisons. So, Mr. Chair and members, I think that concludes. Oh, I'm sorry. It certainly doesn't conclude my presentation. I've only gone through numbers one and two. Number three is about budget notes from the 2001 session. There weren't any budget notes for this agency, but there was what we were calling last session statements of expectations, not exactly budget notes, though. And the one for this agency directed it to continue measuring progress in attaining performance goals related to the timelines of its publications and the processing of its appeals within the statutory time frame set out for those things, and then to report the results of the agency's performance to the emergency board. And that did occur, and The agency also at that time requested a special purpose appropriation of $37,433 to continue the publications coordinator position for the remainder of the biennium, and the emergency board did allocate that amount.
And then didn't that position disappear during the interim?
Representative Morgan, that position was approved as a limited duration position, so it was phased out in the development of the governor's budget. It has been requested to be added back as a permanent position, and the agency can speak a little bit more on what's going on with that position. It actually is vacant right now. The person did leave that position. Number four has to do with audit reports. There were none issued on this agency during the interim. Number five, interim reports and studies. Again, there were none. Number six, fee adjustments. Again, none for this agency. Number seven, significant policy or oversight issues considered by the emergency board and or interim committees. And I just noted there about the emergency board receiving the report on the progress on the agency's progress in attaining the performance goals and receiving the special purpose appropriation. And then number eight, finally, relevant issues, trends, or special challenges. And I've just noted down there that the agency has a challenge in avoiding a recurrent backlog that was experienced during the 90s, especially in light of the budget reductions that occur or could occur to their budget. So that wraps up my introduction and orientation.
Did you speak to this?
Mr. Chair, that is the agency's more detailed presentation, and they will be speaking from that document when they come up to do their part in this presentation.
Okay.
And that would be next, actually.
Any questions at this point? Yes, Senator Duke.
Can we get... special session numbers. I get confused. Some descriptions have them and some don't. I mean, a 103 legislatively approved is sort of a fantasy to me.
Yeah.
I try to work off the fifth special session.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members,
and maybe there's no difference in this budget.
I don't know. In this case, the handout that I provided for you from the Legislative Fiscal Office, I'll go over that table for you just real briefly. Obviously, the 9901 actuals, that's pretty self-explanatory. The 0103 legislatively adopted amount is that amount that was adopted as of the close of the 2001 regular session. And I do note there that our figure includes the special purpose appropriation that was put in the emergency fund for this agency. Mm-hmm. You might see other adopted numbers that don't include that, and that's or see differences, and that's probably the explanation. The 0103 legislatively approved number that you see there is through the fifth special session.
Okay.
And you might see others where it isn't, but this one is. And then the 0305 governor's recommended is self-explanatory.
And then you mentioned with the failure of Measure 28, some changes. I thought all of those were already figured into the budget.
They are.
Are they in the legislatively approved?
That's correct. In this table, Senator Dukes, this does include those House Bill 5100 reductions because it's our current law.
Good.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. I'd like to call Mike Holston and Lisa Pearson.
Okay, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I want to make sure that everybody's got a copy of this document. What I've done to try to make it a little easier to deal with thumbing back and forth between pages is the back portion of the document in the green pages are a number of charts and things that I'll refer to occasionally as I go through the document. What I'm going to try to do today, we basically worked from the outline that was given to us on the presentation format, and that format suggested that we collapse the presentation for small agencies like ours so there wouldn't be too much duplication. So we've tried to do that, and we've tried to do that in a way that preserves all the information, but it gets a little complicated if you're going to be trying to follow the handout that we were given, because we don't track it exactly, but we've tried to cover all the information. What I'm going to try to do this afternoon is to give you as complete a picture as I can of what LUBA does and what the various budgeting options that you're going to be considering, what the impact of those would be on LUBA. I'll try not to give you more detail than you want, but I've elected to go with a fairly detailed presentation. I can pare it back if you're hearing more than you want to hear, and I'll be more than happy to do that. And on the other hand, if I'm glossing over things too quickly, holler at me and I'll try to give you additional detail. Okay, I'm going to begin on page one of the document I handed you. LUBA was created in 1979, and the situation that led to the creation of LUBA in 1979 was that the land use system was becoming sufficiently complex, and the circuit courts were struggling to a degree with the land use decisions that were being appealed to them, that these appeals were getting hung up in circuit court and taking too long, and the track record of the Court of Appeals and reviews of those decisions was getting increasingly poor. LUBA was created to address that situation, and one of the overriding features of the land use program from the very beginning has been that the quid pro quo for a fairly detailed, comprehensive land use program is that the decisions ought to be, individual land use decisions should progress through the system in as speedy a way as possible. So that is one of the key reasons for creating LUBA in the first place. As you're probably aware, we've got statutes that require local governments to make decisions on certain land use decisions, that's permits and rezoning decisions primarily. They have to make decisions on those within 120 days or 150 days, depending on the decision. Once that process comes to a completion, then you've got a decision that could potentially be appealed to LUBA. And the process at LUBA, which I'll go through in a little more detail in just a second, requires that we issue a decision within 77 days after the local record's filed with us. There are statutes that govern the process after LUBA issues its decision and requires speedy appellate court review. There's a deadline there that's a little softer deadline. I can tell you that the Court of Appeals historically has adhered very strictly to their statutory deadlines as well. So that in a nutshell is the explanation for how LUBA came into existence. I've set out some of the goals from our budget document. I won't go over those in detail here. The next item that was requested is how our services are delivered and to whom. Our primary service contact is with the 240 cities and 36 counties that adopt land use regulations and comprehensive plans and make land use decisions that are potentially appealable to us. We deal with a variety of appellants and parties. We've got applicants that appeal decisions. We've got their supporters who participate in appeals at LUBA. Opponents and interest groups. Some of the interest groups you probably recognize. Thousand Friends of Oregon is the frequent party. Oregonians in Action appears. Oregon Farm Bureau.
If I might break in, Mr. Holson, I see in your document here you also state that you deal with a number of state and regional agencies. I did not realize that. Could you break that out for us?
We don't review very many state agency decisions, but the land use program does define certain state agency decisions that have to apply the statewide planning goals as land use decisions that are potentially appealable to LUBA. There's a large number of exceptions to that, and the biggest one being primarily if it's a contested case decision, those go straight to the Court of Appeals. And that rules out an awful lot of them. But there are still some decisions that these state agencies make that don't proceed through a contested case procedure that potentially are appealable to us.
Would that be parks, DSL, or I'm trying to get a picture of what
ODOT
we're talking about.
Is one. Parks, we have had parks decisions. I'm having trouble thinking. In the early days, there were a few Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife decisions. We've not had one of those in quite a long time. I would say primarily ODOT, and they have to do with highway facilities.
And when we're talking about regional agencies, what would that be?
primarily metro. But we've had a few decisions from councils of government. Lane Cog is one. The appellate process that we follow at LUBA is very similar to the one at the Court of Appeals. It's actually modeled after the Court of Appeals briefing and review process. If you can flip back to exhibit or to Appendix B, the second green page. Actually, I passed over exhibit Appendix A. Let's take a quick look at that one first. Starting off at the top left, we've got the legislative branch, and the primary role of the legislative branch in the land use, the greater land use planning and scheme is the adoption of land use statutes that impose substantive land use law. The exclusive farm use zone is probably the best example of that. But there are a variety of enabling statutes as well, the primary one being the creation of LCDC and the Department of Land Conservation and Development. From there, that agency has, as you know, have adopted a number of statewide planning goals. And then over the years, a variety of administrative rules that interpret those statewide planning goals. And the counties and cities that are shown in the next block, in addition to adopting plans and land use regulations to pursue whatever purely local matters they wish to pursue, are required by law to adopt their plans and land use regulations in a way that complies with those goals. And then once that's done, and that has been done in this by this time, all these cities and counties, as they amend those plans and land use regulations, those decisions are potentially appealable to LUBA. And that shows by the arrow going off, the first arrow going off toward LUBA. And then you've got this fairly large number of permit, what I've just referred to as permit decisions. DLCD, I believe, used to estimate that on the order of 10,000 land use decisions are made in the state each year. And about 200 of those get appealed to LUBA each year. And you'll see here over the circuit court is now essentially cut out of the loop and have been since the mid-1970s, actually. Our current estimate is that approximately 10 to 15% of our decisions go beyond LUBA and get appealed to the Court of Appeals. So you have a few that make it as high as the Court of Appeals. I took a quick look before I came over. And since 1996, the Supreme Court...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Could you give us the number again about how many of the cases that you get go to the appeals court?
I took a quick look. The last 3 years, it's on about 20 each year. And that's about 10%.
Okay.
And then, as I was indicating, once the Court of Appeals issues their decisions, the Supreme Court's only taken 3 land use cases since 1996. They've got one pending up there now. So, as you can see, they weeded out fairly quickly, and that's generally the breakout. Over on Appendix B, I'll walk you real quickly through the life of an appeal of LUBA. We begin at the left top box. And at this point, we've already been through the local government procedure, and we have a decision that's final. Once that's done, anyone who wants to appeal the decision has to do so within 21 days. And they file a document at LUBA called a Notice of Intent to Appeal to do that. Once that's done, we, on the same day we've received the appeal, we let the city or county know that we've received the appeal, and they have 21 days to collect the record that was made in support of that decision, make copies of it, bind it, and file it with LUBA, and send copies of it to the petitioner, the person who's filed the appeal. Once that's done is when the 77-day clock that we have to observe begins. And during that 77-day period, the typical appeal allows 21 days for the appellant to file their brief, additional 21 days for the city and any other parties that intervene to defend the decision to file their brief. Then about 7 to 14 days after that, we conduct oral argument over in our offices. And then that leaves us around 21 to 28 days to write the opinion, circulate it among the 3 board members, reach an agreement, and issue the opinion. And then, as I indicated below, or earlier, the it either ends there or can potentially be appealed to the Court of Appeals with expedited review there as well. Any questions on that?
I'm wondering on the just clarification for me. Do you deal only with the record established at the county level or city level then, or do you take new evidence in your
We area? Almost. There is a provision for us to take additional evidence, but it's very narrowly circumscribed, and we almost never do it. We've had probably less than 5 evidentiary hearings in the last 10 years. It's almost always limited to the record.
Any other questions? Okay.
Okay, I'm going to flip back then to page 2 of my outline. The next topic I'd like to touch on are performance measures. We went, like all other state agencies, we went through a fairly significant review of our performance measures in 2002. We revised each of the measures that we already had, and we adopted some new ones. Those are set out in some fairly significant detail in the budget document itself. And I've attached as appendices E and F those pages from the budget document. I can go through those if you want, but I thought I would jump back to the one on appendix F, the first page of that one, which is the easiest to digest and most straightforward of those. And what that sets out in a graphic, a 2-page graphic, what the agency's performance measures are. I'll take a quick look at the first one, at least. We consider that one to be the main driver at the agency, and that is the percentage of appeals that get resolved within the statutory deadlines. And you can see, as was indicated earlier, the difficulty the agency was encountering in the mid to late 90s, even early into the 2000s. Years after 2000. The figures for 2002 are available now, but unfortunately did not make it into this document. The figure for 2002 wound up being 95% of the appeals being decided within the statutory deadline or no more than a 7-day stipulated extension. And quickly down, I'll just mention a couple of things about the remaining ones. We have a performance measure on record objections because that can slow appeals down as well. And there's a statute that requires that we resolve any record objections within 60 days, and that was adopted with some concerns that occasionally record objections were not being decided as quickly as they should be, and they were slowing appeals down. So we adopted a performance measure specifically to address that.
On your bullet point number 2, the 90% are resolved in 60 days. I would assume that of that 10% that's not resolved in 60 days, some of them the appealant is agreeing to an extension. Are there any of those that are not agreeing to an extension?
I can't guarantee you that we've never failed to meet that deadline, but most of the ones that don't meet that 60-day deadline on the record objections are because the parties are using the record objection, which stops the appeal, to try to either work out differences on the record or work out other differences that might resolve the entire appeal. That's a frequent technique that's used by the parties.
So you don't recall any objections to extending the time period then? Or objecting to the extension?
Extensions on issuing an order on a record objection?
On the 60 days, beyond the 60 days, right?
I can't recall.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's slip back over to page 3 of the outline. Our third performance measure, issues resolved. This also revolves around a statute that was adopted. A technique that appellate courts use both as a sound principle of judicial review and as an economy measure. When they reach a issue that resolves the case in the sense that it's going to have to be remanded back to the decision-making body, appellate courts typically will stop there. They won't consider any other issues that may be presented in that appeal. In its early years, LUBA did that as well, and there was a concern that issues that were in that first appeal would here again in a subsequent appeal of the decision once it was an attempt was made to correct the decision. So the statute was adopted to direct that LUBA, to the extent we can do so within the 77-day period, address and resolve all the issues that are fairly presented in the appeal. And so we have this performance measure to do that. Performance measure 4, appellate court review, is a target that we've set. It's basically a quality control performance measure. If you didn't care whether the Court of Appeals was going to affirm the decision or agree with your decision, it would be very easy to meet your 77-day deadline. This target is set so that we can we attempt to make sure that the decision, if it's appealed past us, is affirmed on appeal. The fifth performance measure goes to the published legal reports. That had fallen, like as I indicated earlier, that had fallen substantially behind. We're back on target with the legal reports. This is a reporter that we issue that allows people to, it gives them a research tool that they can go to try to figure out what some of these complicated statewide planning goals really mean. And a lot of times the goals are written in very general language, and there's a whole body of case law out there that's developed to help explain what those particular goals require. And there's an interaction between strictly the general goal language and the administrative rules that have been adopted to implement them as well. So that's my main feature used by that, served by that, that reporter. It also allows the parties in the LUBA appeal itself to develop their legal arguments to us about what the law is and what they think it, what we should interpret the law to say. I'm over on page 4 now. After we developed an agency webpage, one of the things that we began doing that we've gotten the most positive feedback from probably of anything that we've done is to post our slip opinions immediately on the webpage so that if somebody hears about a case, they can just log on, go to the webpage, and download a copy of it immediately. The performance measure 7.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan.
For the post-slip opinions, you don't have any data. Is that one that you're not doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the data. Reason we don't have data on that one is that's a brand new performance measure. We could give you the figures from June to December 2002. It's just that they didn't make it into this document.
Okay.
I'm in the process of pulling that information together. The Headnote Digest is a legal research tool that's posted on our webpage, and it basically is an indexed method of accessing key points of law that we've decided in individual opinions, and it's used by the parties. We use it as well, and the parties that argue cases to us use it. And then the final one is one that LUBA has began doing very early in its existence, and we've tried to continue it over the years, and it's to schedule at least some of our oral arguments outside of Salem in the city or county that rendered the decision. It's a very well-received thing that we do, and we intend to continue doing that. Okay, I'm over on page 5 of my document now, and it's the factors affecting service. As you might expect, the number of appeals that we receive at LUBA closely track the health of the economy. And the chart that I've attached as Appendix G demonstrates the variation in the annual numbers of appeals that we've had over the years since LUBA was created in 1979. I point out one, the spike that you see in appeals in the year 2000 represents a chunk of about 50-some-odd appeals that was filed following ballot measure 7. Had those appeals not been filed, the numbers of appeals would have been about 200, and that's what it has seemed to have leveled off at. Um, We've indicated on that chart that we expect the number of appeals that we will be having to deal with over the next biennium are going to be around 200 appeals, probably more than that if the economy recovers more robustly than is currently anticipated. But our budget assumptions are that it's going to be remaining at about the 200 appeals that it historically has. One of the...
Mr. Chair?
Representative Morgan.
I may have missed this because of this... reading off this sheet. Why was there a big spike in 2000?
The spike in 2000, Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the spike in 2000 was attributable to ballot measure 7. There was one of the features of ballot measure 7 was that immediately after the election in November, a number of cities and counties adopted ordinances that would have allowed them to waive the regulation that was issued, might be at issue in a claim for compensation under ballot measure 11. There were approximately 50, in excess of 50 appeals filed to challenge those ordinances. All of those appeals were suspended while the litigation proceeded through the Marion County Circuit Court into the Supreme Court. And we are in the process now of dismissing all of those appeals.
So did you actually, were they suspended before you put any staff time into them?
They were suspended before we put any staff time into resolving the appeal. There was a fair amount of staff time in working with the parties and the 50 separate appeals to suspend them, because they were not all suspended in precisely the same way. But everyone, I think, recognized that there was litigation pending under 7. There was no interest on any party's part in proceeding with a LUBA review until they knew whether the ballot measure can be held constitutional. So there was nowhere near the level of work that would have been required had we had to actually resolve all those appeals on the merits, although I suspect the legal issues would have been reasonably similar from appeal to appeal, so it wouldn't have been like it would have been 50 separate appeals with vastly different legal issues.
Thank you.
A budgetary concern on the part of, on the Department of Land Conservation and Development we have heard about is that their activity of what they call periodic review, which is a process that they go through periodically to review city and county comprehensive plans to make sure that they're up to date and consistent with current land use laws. Budget-reducing technique that DLCD has considered is to de-emphasize periodic review. That would make a lot of sense from their standpoint, I suspect, because I assume a fair amount of staff resources go into periodic review. The consequence of that, there may be consequences of that, though, because those plan amendments that would otherwise be reviewed in periodic review, if they're not handled there, are adopted in the format of what's called post-acknowledgement plan amendments, and those come to LUBA. So we potentially could see a spike in appeals attributable to that if DLCD were to de-emphasize periodic review. I just note that, and I don't know whether they continue to intend to do that, but it's one measure that I know that they've been considering. I don't know that I need to reiterate this. The land use program has changed dramatically since 1973 when the statewide planning goals were adopted. And it's both the initial adoption of those goals and the adoption of a significant number of administrative rules that interpret and apply those goals by DLCD has dramatically increased the regulatory framework that we have to do. Land use applicants have to deal with, and the appeals of those decisions that come to us, in turn, we have to deal with them. We have an awful lot of cities and counties that never had planning and zoning until the statewide planning program began. So we had a multi-factor increase in the amount of and complexity of the law. I'm moving over to item 5 on page 6 of the outline. I'm not going to be able to give you hard figures on this, but one of the relatively frequent occurrences that we experience in appeals at LUBA is that the parties will tell us that they want to suspend the appeal to allow them time to try to work out the dispute. And sometimes the parties just do that on their own, and then other times they're taking advantage of a program that the Department of Land Conservation and Development offers through the Public Policy Dispute Resolution Program. They have some limited funds that allows the department to subsidize, to pay the cost of a mediator to help the parties in a land use dispute work out their differences, and if they do, dismiss the LUBA appeal. There's a statute that allows us to suspend the appeal for that purpose, and there's a statute that allows the Court of Appeals to do the same thing if the mediation effort happens after our decision is issued. Moving on to revenue resources, the Legislative Fiscal Office covered that. We have two sources of revenue. We sell the LUBA reports, and that partially funds the cost of physical cost of producing the reports, and part of the salary of the publications coordinator that works to produce that report. And the other revenue that we have is the filing fee that we charge, which is currently $175 for an appeal.
Chairman, I ask a question.
Representative Morgan.
The material that you have posted on the web, is there a charge to be able to use that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we make no charge for anybody to pull things off the web, and we actually don't even charge if people call and ask us to mail them copies. As it works out, it's more expensive for us to seek reimbursement than it is just to copy and send it. I should qualify that. If they want a huge amount of paper, then we do charge a per page fee, but that's the only.
So the post slip opinions, which I think, yeah, they're on your web page, and then is the headnote digest a web function or a function of the publication?
The headnote digest is a byproduct of our publication process. In publishing our reports, we have these indexed principles of law that go into the digest into the reports itself. So to facilitate finding the case you want, that's got the legal principle in it that you're looking for.
And so, is that part of the bound volume?
It is part of the bound volume, but. In addition to that, if you pay $175 for that volume, you get that. If you don't buy the bound volume, you can still go onto our web page and access this digest that lets you do that same legal research. You won't have the book, but you can identify the case that has that legal principle in it. And then you can either go obtain a copy of the LUBA reports, or failing that, you can pull a copy of that opinion down from our web page.
Is what's in the bound volume available on the website too?
Not in that format. What's available on our web page is what we call the slip opinion. That is the raw opinion as we issue it. That's the one we've got to get out the door by 77 days. The LUBA reports is a more refined product that has this research tool with it that lets you. Rather than having to deal with a stack 2 feet high of slip opinions, it's a much smaller document. It's indexed, that lets you more efficiently find the principles of law that you're trying to locate.
So if I was, will you indulge me while I do this?
Certainly.
If I was a lawyer that did land use issues and was interested in researching what the decisions were in LUBA, would I, as a matter of course, purchase the volume, or would I be able to get that information off the website?
Most of the lawyers that do much of a practice before LUBA either purchase our reporter or have access to it. Most of the major law libraries, and even some of the not-so-major law libraries, have copies of our reporter, so they can go down to their law library and use it. If they don't have that kind of access, and if they don't receive a copy of our reporter, it's not as good as having access to that, but through our web page with this headnote digest and access to the slip opinions, they can... they could argue their case to us. They're not going to be able to give us the official citations that we prefer, but they can find the law. It just takes a little bit more work to do it.
Okay. What I'm trying to get to here is, are we giving away information for free that, you know, through a portal that other people pay for? But it sounds like there's a qualitative difference to the information.
Okay. That's, in a sense, that's true. There's another resource out there that I haven't mentioned that almost all lawyers do have ready access to, and that's Westlaw and Lexis. These are legal publishers. And both of those services offer our opinions as well. And I would say most of the lawyers that don't practice frequently at LUBA do have access to that. They would probably use that over our web page and the EdNote Digest that I was talking about, just because it's much more efficient, and they're more used to using that, either Westlaw or Lexis.
Well, how do the opinions get from your agency into that publication or database or whatever it is?
The way that happens, and it's been we've been doing that since early 90s. First with Westlaw, and more recently with Lexis. Each month, we send out our slip opinions to Westlaw and to Lexis. We very early on with Westlaw negotiated a contract with them, whereby in exchange for us giving what's essentially public information anyway, but we give it to them in a format that's easy for them to use, and we give it to them instantly. In exchange for that, they have given us free licenses to use their databases.
Oh,
so
okay.
We get something out of the deal, too. So we get to use Westlaw free of charge, essentially, and we get 7 licenses to do that. That's worth about $1,000 a piece for the Oregon database.
Okay, thank you. That was something that I didn't know about. It's good to get that information.
I was going to brief. I'm moving on to item 8 on page 7 of my outline. LUBA, when it was initially created in 1979, was made up of 3 board members. The board members have had to have the same qualifications from the very beginning. They're required to be members of the Oregon State Bar in good standing. They're supposed to be experts in land use law. And as initially created, LUBA had 2 administrative staff persons. And that's how that was the shape of LUBA up until the mid-90s. Early LUBA, the publications were handled by a different legal publisher called Butterworth. And when that arrangement was in fact, basically LUBA had no obligation or work to do to create the publications. Butterworth did all that work for them. In 1985, that changed. It was primarily because Butterworth was not able to make money selling the LUBA reports and fell quite a ways behind. LUBA took over the publication of its opinions. And with that added responsibility and the increasing number of appeals that began in about 1991, that's when we started to experience in excess of 200 appeals a year, LUBA started to become falling behind again. Moving on to page 8, we really reached sort of a peak in the difficulties in the backlog of appeals at LUBA between 1995 and 1999. And there were a number of factors that contributed to that. There were an extraordinarily large number of appeals during those years, the biggest year being about 260 appeals. There was a complete turnover of LUBA board members in 1995, so there was a learning curve period there that had to happen that resulted in some additional backlog. And at the worst of this period of time, LUBA was only issuing about 59% of its final opinions on time. And it was even worse than that number might indicate, because on the opinions on the merits, because that includes a lot of cases that were resolved in a perfunctory way and didn't require a great deal of work on LUBA's part. If you looked at the opinions that were actually issued on the merits, At its worst, we were approximately 6 months behind the statutory deadline. So if you had an opinion that was due July 1, you weren't getting it until late in December. At about the same time this was going on was when the first staff attorney position was authorized. Once that staff attorney position came on board and began to be showing results, there was legislative authorization for a second limited duration staff attorney. During that period of time, it became clear that one of the main problems that we were having was trying to publish the LUBA reports. The board members were much better lawyers than they were publishers, and decided that rather than have two staff attorneys, they would change that structure and eliminate one of the staff attorney positions and go to this publication coordinator, which is much, that position actually serves much more than just the publications function. A person who occupies that position has a sort of a critical role in the opinion issuing process because they participate in the final downdrafting phase of issuing our opinions. They're the ones that go over the opinions with a fine-tooth comb to make sure that the record sites are correct, the case citations are correct, and it's written in a way that hopefully makes sense to the parties.
Mike, could I ask you, when you say the opinions on the merit, the non-legal person, I'm not sure what that means. I would understand that you would judge and have opinions on whether the process was followed. But when you talk about merits, does that talk about the expert piece of the testimony or the record that's developed, or just that there was an adequate amount of expert opinion?
Mr. Chair, I apologize for speaking legalese. When I say an opinion on the merits, and that's kind of a vague concept, but what I mean is a case where we actually have a brief, the briefs are filed, we have oral argument, and there are legal issues that we have to get in there and sort out, whatever they may be. They could be procedural issues, they could be substantive issues. They typically are a combination of the two. An opinion that's not an opinion on the merits is one that gets resolved most frequently by agreement of the parties. The parties, maybe after the briefs are filed, maybe even after oral argument, but before we issue our opinion, the parties come to us and say, we've resolved our differences, we want you to dismiss the appeal. So that's what I mean when I say that.
This has been a while since I've heard this, but I have had the complaint that I believe it was LUBA that was making decisions at one point, at least based on expert opinion or expert information that was offered in the hearings at the local level. And at that time, the question was, does LUBA have enough expertise that they're available to them to be able to make those kind of decisions? And that's where I was coming from with the question. Maybe you don't even judge it on that basis at this point.
Well, let me step back. The typical complicated land use proceeding, you are going to get into a situation where expert testimony is presented, let's say, to a Board of County Commissioners. At that stage, you know, you've got boards of, you know, members of a Board of County Commission that may or may not be in a position to resolve that kind of expert testimony, but they have to do it. I mean, that's their job, and so they do the best job that they can. When that case comes to us, we apply a fairly deferential standard of review. What we have to decide is, based on that evidence that was presented to that Board of County Commissioners, would a reasonable Board of Commissioners have decided the case the way that they do? And we are not supposed to go in and try to second-guess them on the way they resolved expert testimony, unless looking at what we've got to look at in the record, we come to the conclusion that a reasonable person just simply wouldn't have decided it that way. That's the way it works, and I can imagine that you may have received complaints that in a particular case where that was the issue that was presented at LUBA, that, you know, given this expert testimony going this way and this expert testimony going this way, it was unreasonable for them to have gone with these experts, and we just routinely have to make that call. Frequently, yes. I mean, some of these cases with very technical issues involved. And it's, I'm frankly amazed that a lot of local governments can do as good a job as they do.
Thank you.
One of the things that I've, this publications coordinator has allowed us to do is basically let the staff attorney focus on writing opinions and helping us get the opinions out on time. Basically does that in two ways. Makes by being able to assume that final editing, participate in the final editing process, which is a fairly, requires somebody with a fair amount of skill. The staff attorney certainly can do it, but if you have a publications coordinator that's capable of doing it, then you free up that attorney time to be used on our main mission, which is resolving the appeals. I indicated at the bottom of that page that we are now current on opinions and have been since about July of 2001, and we've been issuing the publications on time since July of 2000.
But at this point, if Mr. Chair, you've lost your, the publications person has left the agency?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the person that was in that position throughout the entire last fall, it was a limited duration position, and I can't fault her for doing this. I mean, she knew that there was a very much of an uncertainty about whether that position was going to be included in the next budget, so she's been job hunting and found another job and took it and left a few weeks ago.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dukes.
This was a very controversial position last session. You came in and requested it, and we kicked it around and chewed on it and kicked it around some more. Did I understand that the emergency board continued it as limited duration?
That's correct.
So you now have it continued through the current biennium?
Through the current biennium.
Okay, and you're requesting...
The governor's balanced budget request is that that position be authorized as a permanent position.
Okay. Yeah, I remember all the controversy last session as to was it really needed, considering the scope of things that you do.
Well, I remember discussion, too, that we wanted to be able to track that it was going to alleviate the backlog and that the holding the second year of funding in the e-board was to kind of make sure that the money was being spent well.
Mm-hmm.
So do you intend to fill that position then before the end of the biennium?
That's our intent. As you can probably, we're just gearing up for the recruiting effort, and as you can imagine, with a position that's only funded for another few months, for sure, depending on the outcome of this, if that position's continued in the next biennium, I'm reasonably certain that we can fill it.
But if you make the decision to hold off on hiring somebody until you see what the outcome of your 03-05 budget is, what kind of impact is that going to have on getting behind again?
We do not intend to hold off on trying to refill the position. I'm just anticipating that I'm going to have some difficulty hiring somebody for a job that's only funded for another couple of months or 3 months, depending on when we're able to fill it.
Okay. Any other questions?
Are those folks from your district back there?
Well, I'd like to break in here for just a second. Sean, we have some FFA students here if they'd like to introduce themselves quickly.
This is Elias and Kate. My name is Elias Aguirre, State Vice President for Oregon FFA, and I'm from Jordan Valley, Oregon.
My name is Katie Owens. I'm from Baker City, and I am Oregon FFA State Sentinel.
Oh, we welcome you to our committee.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sean. Proceed.
I'm going to proceed on to item 9. The first item is the item that I mentioned just a minute ago with Westlaw and Lexis, the agreement that we worked out with Westlaw, and we're trying to negotiate now with Lexis. They're difficult people to negotiate with. They are hard to track down. The person's got authority to give you what you want, what you're trying to get. But we're trying to obtain a similar deal with Lexis that we've got with Westlaw. I won't go through these other items unless you want me to. These are within the current budget situation. We've done a number of things to try to reduce our expenditures. And
yes, set out question.
Representative Morgan?
The economies that you've made, the board members paying their own travel expenses and delaying the computer upgrades, and were those as a result of the cuts because of the special sessions, or were these decisions that you've made prior to that?
We've never had a budget item per se for travel. We've on occasion, when it looks like our budget's in trouble, we'll just start paying our own travel. When it looks like there's been money and enough money in the budget to cover it, we've charged it. But I certainly began it with the beginning of last year. I don't think anybody's been turning in expense vouchers for travel that we do.
Appreciate that in these times. Representative Johnson.
2 points that have no connection with each other. The first one is that I presume your board are all volunteers. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we're all full-time employees.
Okay, the three attorneys are.
Three board members, yeah.
Right, and then is there a citizen board on top of that, or are these the three attorneys that are not turning in their travel time?
It's the three attorneys.
There is no citizen
board. There is no board.
Okay. I'm sorry, I misunderstood that. I guess the point that I'm trying to make here is that this is laudable for these folks to be doing it. It seems that if it's hit and miss through state government, it could have the net effect of a disproportionate burden on folks that, in a budget crisis, step up in a leadership way and say, we'll forego this. And I'm aware that there are some citizen boards that are not paid staff that are reimbursed for travel. And I just think that at some point in the Ways and Means process, we might want to revisit those boards or citizen boards or paid staff that are voluntarily foregoing that level of compensation. I just hate to see it be a hit and miss.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't want it to sound like we think we're going to have some kind of martyr because we're doing this. We only do about 4 oral arguments outside of Salem each year, and it's
okay. Well, that helps put it in perspective.
So it's for those boards that are traveling constantly. It would be a very different proposition.
Second question, Mr. Chair.
To your district, you can put them up at your house.
There you go. The second question, completely unrelated, is that I noted with interest that you contract with the PUC for what are ostensibly backroom functions, accounting and personnel. How's that worked out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it's worked out. It was rocky at first, and we've over a period of time, things to seem to have worked out so that it's reasonably acceptable right now.
The reason for my question, Mr. Chair, is I'm wondering if this sets an example for other shared back rooms rather than replicating the administrative function over and over and over again for small agencies, whether there's something instructive here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't think this is an unusual practice. We had a prior arrangement with Water Resources to do take a similar sort of approach. I don't know if other agencies do it too, but it's
thank you.
Worked out well for us.
I would ask, of this list, have you prioritized these?
I have not, sorry.
And that's something that we've been asked by the co-chairs to have the agencies do. And
my understanding is you've already taken
these
as cost-cutting measures.
Mr. Chair, these are measures that we've already implemented and are doing now.
Well, we've been asked to have an add-back list, though.
So we're going to ask for more cuts. We're not giving any of these back.
No, but should we have a stronger economy, we've been asked to also provide add-back lists.
Oh.
But can I finish my question?
It's that position
about
that we're battering back and forth, maybe.
Happened by the end of the regular session, and which ones of them were results from cuts over the interim? And just real quick and dirty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, item A. The arrangement that we worked with Westlaw has resulted in some economies. We did the first agreement with Westlaw in the mid-90s. And we are currently trying to negotiate a similar deal with Lexis. I have no idea whether we're going to be successful on that, but we're trying to just to get some additional legal research tools for free if we can get
them. So that had nothing to do with our special session?
Had nothing to do with special session.
That's just management.
The travel and lodging costs is something that is not unique to the special session. We've done this in other times when our budget got tight. So it's partially attributable to special session, I suppose, but it's nothing that we haven't done before.
In 0103, did you have any travel budget at all? I don't recall what we did there.
To my knowledge, we've never had anything that's specifically earmarked for travel, but that we could have. If it is, we're talking
obviously
nickels and
not
dimes.
Enough.
It's not talking much in the way of a budget.
Okay.
The contracting with PUC, like I say, it's PUC now. It was Water Resources before, and we've been doing that since the mid-90s as well. The computer upgrades, I think that's fairly attributable to the special session.
Okay.
We've just stopped doing that. And at some point, that position's going to have to change, I suppose.
Something you want to put on your list?
The two administrative assistants who take leave without pay, that's attributable both to the special session and to some special circumstances those two particular personnel had. Just sort of their needs matched the times.
So this was a way they had issues in their personal lives that they wanted to take
that's
extra
correct.
Time.
But it also helped solve your problem with the special session.
The discontinuation of subscriptions, that's something that began quite a while ago, but it's accelerated now. I mean, we basically, we have a bare-bones legal library now. And
are you able to get that information over the Internet or other sources, though?
We are, and, Mr. Chair, we're only three blocks down from the Supreme Court Library. I mean, we just have to, you know, walk out the door and walk up there, and we can get pretty much whatever we need that way. It's a little less efficient, but we can certainly do it.
Plus, there's the benefit of getting the exercise.
Next item, LUBA's strategic business plan. As I've indicated, the budget pages 17 through 19 set out our six-year plan. I just indicate there that the factors that we balance in issuing the opinions, and we've been over that already today. Item 11 is the administrative cost. That's the PUC item. We've got about $14,000 in our budget, biennial budget now, to cover those costs. It's certainly going to be at least that. We've periodically had trouble staying within that budget. PUC, particularly. The real problem we have is when we get into situations like this with budgeting time where we make significant demands on the accounting staff over there for help in putting the budget together and responding to questions. And aging computers. When our computers start doing weird things, we can't shut down. We have to get somebody in there to fix them, and that can be an anticipated cost. Still on page 10, affirmative action. Our affirmative action report appears on page 52 of the budget. Item 13, I go through and talk about our computers. We have eight computers. We've actually got one more computer than we've got staff, but that one is available. We've hung on to an old one because we occasionally get volunteer law students that want to have the experience working in our office, and if they're willing to come work for nothing, give them a spot to work and try to teach them something and get something in return. The key information technology issue for us is the computers that we use to draft our opinions and the related software that we use to access the needed databases. And then the agency diary is used to generate. That's how we keep up with things. That's how we keep from missing deadlines. It's how we stay on top of pending motions and appeals, and monitor a number of other activities. It's that system that rely entirely on PUC staff to help us keep running. And I go through there in the top of page 11 some of the resources that are available on the webpage. that we've already talked about today. Other things that you can access on our webpage via links are our administrative rules, DLCD's administrative rules, land use statutes, a whole variety of resources. You can. One thing that we increasingly use, too, is you've got fairly easy access now via the web to city and county comprehensive plans and zoning ordinances. It's generally the best way to get access to the most up-to-date document. The next item that was set out in the outline are some discussion of the essential packages. Our budget, on budget page 45 of our budget document, sets out various charges that we're assessed as a state agency. They cover quite a range, all the way from Capital Planning Commission to the Supreme Court Library to Secretary of State Audit, a variety of things, and the numbers associated with that are set out on that page. Those typically inflate each year, but for some reason this year a number of them went down at the same time, some went up, so they largely offset, so it's pretty much not much of an increase. That takes us to the various reduction options that have been discussed. The governor's balanced budget proposes, I skipped over before, but our organization chart appears on Appendix C, the existing organization chart. If you identify at the bottom, sort of toward the right-hand corner, you get the administrative support specialist, mark that position, and the publications coordinator, and then across from that, what's called the land use law analyst here, that's our staff attorney. Those are the positions that are affected by various options, actually the board members as well, affected by various options that have been considered during this budgeting cycle. The 10% reduction that's required, to achieve that reduction, the agency identified the elimination of the staff attorney position as the most logical way to achieve that kind of a reduction. The main impact of doing
Mr.
that...
Mr. Chair, which one of these is the staff attorney?
On the chart, it's the lower left-hand corner. It's called Land Use Law Analyst.
Law Analyst. Okay.
The main impact of eliminating the staff attorney position is that you base, if you view it as 40-hour weeks for four people, you've got 160 hours of potential work hours each week to deal with the opinions. As a practical matter, you don't really have 160 hours because we all have administrative duties, meetings that we have to attend that detract somewhat from that. But taking that as a working number, if the staff attorney is eliminated, we go down to 120 hours a week. The staff attorney is not... The work that's produced doesn't exactly match that's cranked out by each board member, but it's pretty close. And we rely heavily on the staff attorney for various, for legal research on contested issues, actually draft opinions. So that would be the impact. It would be roughly taking your capacity down by roughly a quarter. It's our estimate that if that were to happen, even with the existing level of appeals that we've got, we would begin incurring a backlog again. And the severity of that backlog would depend primarily on whether we stay at our approximately 200 appeals per year, in which case the backlog might not be terribly severe, but if those appeals take back off and get up to 100, 220 a year again, we could very quickly get into serious problems again.
The position right now, the person, how long has the person that's there been in that position?
The particular person that's in that position right now, I believe, has been there since the year 2000. It was created, this permanent position as it exists now came into effect in 1999. There was someone in there for, I think, approximately a year before the current person came on board.
So they've been there for 2 years now?
Approximately 2 years.
Okay. What I'm wondering is, if the choice is made to eliminate this position, and then at some point in the future it gets restored when we pull out of this economic trough that we're in, what are the issues surrounding somebody kind of getting to a place where they understand the process and the legal issues so that they're actually productive?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that's always a huge question mark. You hope that you would be able to get somebody with enough experience where they're going to be productive fairly quickly. You just never know whether that's totally going to be possible or not. The particular person that's in there now, he hired from a law firm in Medford, and he was he's been excellent from the day one. Were to come to that, we would hope we'd be able to find somebody as good as him the second time around, but you never, that's certainly not a sure thing. The 30% reduction that's also been requested is set out on page 12 of the outline. That essentially, there's no way to avoid reducing board members at that level, and the proposal would be to eliminate one board member position, reduce one of the two remaining board members to 0.85 FTE, and eliminate one of the two administrative staff positions. That would represent basically a catastrophe for the agency. We would certainly be back to the backlog situation. Probably would not be able to publish. It'd be very difficult to carry out the publication function and issue opinions on time.
So 30%, you would reduce it to almost two full-time board members?
Correct.
What would happen if you had them disagreeing on...
Well, as I noted there, we've put a little thought into that. The way the statute's written right now, each board member technically can issue an opinion on his or her own. I think in that situation you would have a rule of necessity that would evolve, and if the two board members disagreed, I believe the only way that I can think of to resolve that would be have the board chair be the one who would make the decision in that particular case, and that would be the board's opinion, and it would stand on its merits if it was appealed.
I would suspect that in that case, the number of cases that went to the appeals court would
skyrocket.
Yeah. Have you, your board, looked into contracting out the publications position to other courts or other bodies?
Mr. Chair, that is essentially what LUBA did between 1985 and the time that the publications coordinator position came on board. It was a collection of the board members drafted the what are called the headnotes. During those periods of time when we had a staff attorney, the staff attorney took those headnotes and did some of the work on the publications, and we contracted out the rest. And we still contract out part of the process. We don't do the actual printing in-house. We contract with a printer to print the document up, and we contract with a state printer to do that, and with a private concern to actually do the binding through the state printer. What we've been able to achieve with the publications coordinator is we have much more control over the process. We control our own destiny, whereas before you were at the mercy of these independent contractors, some of whom were quite good and some of whom were not so good.
If you developed the backlog, could you do that for part of the workload, though?
The short answer is yes. What we're attempting to do at this point right now is to have one of our two administrative staff persons babysit the publications process so that we can avoid having to go contract out that work. And it remains to be seen whether we're going to be successful in that, but that's what we're trying to do at the moment.
Senator Dukes?
We increased the cost of some of your publications 2 years ago as in an attempt to raise some funds.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I my memory is failing me a little bit now. I know that the filing fee to file an appeal, which is a different fee, was raised a number of years ago. The price that we charge for our publications, I believe, was increased slightly a number of years ago, but the precise year.
There was some question about the things that the lawyers buy that we were going to increase the price of those, so we discussed it, and I remember being concerned because they can now get it online, so I wasn't absolutely sure why they were going to come buy it from us if we raised the price very high. But I thought we had done that as a way of trying to cover some of the publications position.
Well, right now we charge $175. I wish I should have brought one of the volumes along with it. So you don't get very much for $175, but that's what we charge for it. When we got up past about $125 a volume, we started losing subscribers. It's pretty much stabilized at $70. But as I indicated before, we've got a number of relatively small rural law libraries that still subscribe, and those are the ones we're concerned about. Not both because we don't want them to stop subscribing, but also if we raise it to $200 and we lose a bunch of subscribers, we're going to net out less.
And I wasn't thinking about going up. When did we go to 175?
I'm working from memory, but I think it was 2-3 years ago, perhaps.
That's what I'm thinking of. Okay.
Lieutenant Krager, do you have any questions?
No.
I'll make sure you're still with us.
I'm right here.
We're going to run out of time.
Okay. We'll move along here. We probably do need to move along. We've got a little over half hour left, and I know we have some public testimony. So.
Okay. Well, I'm, Mr. Chair, I'm almost done.
Okay.
We've got, as we indicated on item D on page 13, as we indicated, we've got the current vacancy in the publications coordinator position, which we're trying to fill. As of February 1st, we're going to have the vacancy in the staff attorney position, which we're not going to be attempting to fill. The current plan has one of the administrative specialist positions going to 0.5 FTE February 1. And that position will be vacant as soon as we fill the publications coordinator position, because then we'll have to terminate that position. That's how the budgeting balancing worked out. Keeping that person on as a half-time is what's allowing us to try to stay up with the public, to do a babysitting of the publications during this period of time. Item E, the budget, the enhancement packages, that primarily is the publications position we've been talking about. I had treated the direction that we received on the publications coordinator as the equivalent of a budget note. I suppose technically it was not a budget note, but that's what that discussion is about. And the Appendix I is my attachment for the prioritized list of services. I wasn't really sure what I was supposed to put on that, and I assume that what I've got there is probably next to worthless as far as you for a budgeting tool. I understand in some conversations with the legislative fiscal office that we can perhaps hang some numbers on some of these options that have been discussed today that will perhaps be a little more useful to you when it comes time to the work session.
Okay, Morgan.
From my discussions with the co-chairs, and I hope that you'll reality check me on this, but my assumption is that this prioritized list is going to end up being real critical, and I don't know for an agency this size where we're going to go here, because I think that, quite frankly, you're running about as lean as you can run right now. But I think as we go through the process of trying to prioritize an agency's services and match that up against the amount of money we have to spend, that it's going to become pretty critical. But this is pretty simple in the grand scheme of things.
Well, it was helpful to me to find out, Representative, that unlike other courts, they can't choose which appeals they hear. Anyone that files an appeal with LUBA, they have to hear, so they're kind of locked in. So we need to consider that too.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can... That's... essentially, I realize I probably blabbered on longer than you wanted to hear, but that was essentially my presentation, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions if you
got. Representative Johnson and myself, we didn't serve last time on this board, so it's unprofessional. Thank you. Lisa.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services, and I'll real quickly walk through this document here, summarizing how the governor's budget was developed. Starting on page 2, there's a table showing the historical expenditures by fund type and the positions and full-time equivalents. There is an addition this time around of two columns on the right-hand side, one that calculates the difference between the close of session budget and then the difference between the governor's balance budget and the budget through the fifth special session for 2001 and 2003. This agency is one of a handful of unique agencies in that because it is so small, it does not have a significant reduction in general fund. And as we go through the rest of the slides, we'll see why. On page 3, this slide shows the breakdown of the general fund and other funds. About 95% of this agency's budget is general fund, and the remainder is other funds from the Luba report sales. Turning to page 4, this slide summarizes what is in the governor's budget. It is a 10.6% increase from the fifth special session budget for 2001-03, and it includes the elimination of the staff attorney position that you've heard about for the remaining 5 months of this biennium, as well as the elimination of the administrative support staff position. And both of those are in relation to House Bill 5100. Major programs and services included in the governor's budget include the restoration of the staff attorney, the restoration of half of the administrative support position, and then restoration of the publications editor that you've heard so much about.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan.
Do the numbers on page 2 reflect rolling out all the salary increase issues?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, yes. And actually, we're going to get to that slide next.
Okay.
It could be... I believe we're on numbers. The next slide shows that they have one program unit. And moving on to page number 6, this shows that this budget is primarily personal services. So if any reductions are taken, you're really looking at positions rather than being able to go into some other category of expenditure. And slide 7 is where we get into what is actually in more detail in the governor's budget. And starting with that about $1.3 million, it includes legislatively approved actions through April of 2002, and that would include the second special session reduction that was made up primarily with leave without pay from the two administrative specialist positions. And then also the addition of the general fund for the publications editor second year that was approved by the emergency board. Base budget adjustments do, in fact, include the full calculated merit increases and any position changes. Again, the way it was handled in the governor's balanced budget was to have a pot of money that was represented statewide. Individual agencies did not actually get changed at that point, and that will be something that, as we work through work session, will happen to these budgets. The natural resource area budgets are also different from education and public safety and human services in that they retained normal inflation. And normally, inflation is built into the budget process, or it has been. And because of the number of budgets and the relatively small size of this program area in terms of the grand scheme of things, in terms of general fund, we just didn't have time to go through and fix everything. So that is something that will also be addressed in the work sessions by legislative fiscal. But to briefly highlight where the inflation did occur, it did occur on shift differentials, mass transit assessments, and unemployment assessments. And then there were the normal inflationary changes for services and supplies, rent, that sort of thing. Moving on to page 8, start with the policy packages. And the 081 package reflects what occurred in the third special session as it applies to 2003-05. And in this case, this agency had the salary adjustment for salary range 38 and above that you may have already heard about. So that was backed out. The 091 package was the fifth special session, Section 2 reductions, as they applied to 2003-05. And there are a couple elements in there that you've already heard about. The staff attorney would go away completely, and the administrative support specialist would go away completely. And then there's just a very small amount of services and supplies that is also reduced. Now, the 092 package says that it's a reduction package, and that was what it was originally intended for, but it actually wound up being the place that we put any restorations in. And so when the budget was finalized, we went back in and restored staff attorney position because of the concern about backlog and how that either might affect the court system, or it might, if a change in the 77-day statute was applied, might affect economic development. And then we restored half of the administrative specialist position that you've also heard about. And then package 101 is a traditional policy package, and that would be the one that would make the publications editor a permanent full-time position. And that also would help address the backlog issue. And with that, that summarizes the governor's budget for 2003-05.
Thank you, Lisa. Questions in the committee?
A comment, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I want one after she does.
Senator Dukes.
I wanted to say thank you to DAS. Last session, I had a real problem with the fact that a lot of these small agencies were getting dinged for, you know, the planting that was done on the Capitol Mall and the, you know, the rose bushes and things, and it had no relevance to them whatsoever. And I noticed when we went through those charges that somebody's gone in there and they're getting charged for things that actually make sense. So I appreciate that.
Question to Morgan.
First a comment and then a question. I don't know if it was because I chaired this last session and worked through the budget, but I thought your presentation was very clear and easy to follow, and I really appreciate the work that you put into it. It's a good job. The question that I have is on the publications coordinator, if we stay in a tanked out economic situation through 03-05, what do you expect to have happen in terms of publication backlog because of not having very many appeals come through? Have you quantified that at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, if I understand your question, I don't think we've not tried to quantify in any particular way the situation that we're in right now, tanked out in the economy. We're still getting about 180 appeals. That doesn't stretch us, but it's not a situation where we're sitting around twiddling our thumbs either. Suppose we could try to hang some numbers on that if that's something you'd like us to do, but it's, you know, we have some excess capacity right now with 180 appeals. As that goes back up closer to 200, that capacity starts to go away, and as you get up above 220 appeals or so, then you're under the gun again. And the problem is that can happen fairly quickly. I mean, the number of appeals that have been filed so far this month, if we continue at that rate, it's going to be over 200 appeals again.
Okay.
The position did what it was intended to do, didn't it? It eliminated the backlog and caught you up to where you're current, and until that person left, at least you were able, given the current number of filings, you were able to stay current.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, that's correct. The focus of that person when we first hired her was to eliminate the backlog, and that's what we directed most of her efforts toward. As we started having some success with that, that is when we began to expand her responsibilities into participating in actually the opinion writing process, because we were way behind on those too. And as we made that transition, we started making progress catching up on the opinions as well. That took a good bit longer because there was a severe backlog there. But we achieved back. We're back performing at performance level since, I believe, July of 2001.
So the position in the governor's budget, the option package, if we were to take it, do more than just publications?
That's correct.
It's different than we had last session.
Have you, I think I asked you this in my office, but maybe for the benefit of the rest of the group, and I'd like you to maybe go a little farther. Are there cycles throughout the year? Do you have more appeals in certain months than others, or does it stay pretty even?
Mr. Chair, as I indicated to you yesterday, for reasons I've never been able to explain fully, although your explanation is probably about as good as I've heard, we tend to get more appeals in December than any other year. One explanation probably is that's a period of time when there's not a lot of construction going on and people are getting their permits in line. Of course, that continues to go on in January and February, and we don't seem to see that happening as well much there. But we tend to get a spike in appeals in December. I know this past year the appeals dropped off in the middle of the summer, and I don't think that's an unusual phenomenon either. People are out building rather than getting building permits at that point, or conditional use permits and the permits they need to build. So we generally see that fluctuation, but it's not 100% true. We've had summers when we were really cooking with the appeals, and we've had slow winters as well.
Okay. Any other questions?
Chair, yes. If I could just make a comment, one of the things that the co-chairs wanted to have a discussion on was the vacant positions and whether or not they should be continued, and if so, at what step? Should they be budgeted at a second step, or can the agency justify requesting that they be budgeted at a higher step, maybe because of difficulty in hiring or retention issues, something along those lines? It might be helpful to expand the discussion on the current vacant positions, including the staff attorney, which will soon be vacant, and maybe enable the subcommittee to give some direction to LFO and the agency and BAM as to what they might like to see priced out, you know, maybe different configurations of the staffing and what maybe some of those options are, because when we come back it will probably be for work session and not another hearing, so it would be helpful to have some direction along those lines. Not asking you to make a decision since it's not a work session.
Mr. Chair, we had a chance to talk about this just a little bit. We would not anticipate it being a significant problem to recruit at the assumed step two for the staff attorney if that position's restored. I prefer to be able to offer a higher step, but we're not prepared to make a case today that we need that to be able to fill the position. We say the same thing about the publications coordinator position. That step salary range, given the current conditions, we would anticipate we'll be able to fill that position. Probably could do the same for the administrative specialist position, but in the unusual circumstance we're in right now, where that position is currently filled and we may have to let that person go, if we were able to fill that position at a step four, which is what the current person holds that position at, it would be a very much of a benefit to us if that person's still around, because that person could walk in and do the job the next day and we wouldn't have to train them on how to do the position. So I guess the only position I think we would seek to have permission to fill at a slightly higher level to step forward would be the administrative specialist position.
That give you adequate information.
Mr. Chair,
our opinion?
Yeah.
Do you have something to say?
Only that, you know, getting kind of an overview on the snowball we're going to be pushing up the hill this time, that we probably don't want to look at increasing any salary ranges or putting any increased expectations out there at all.
I think we had pretty clear direction from the governor's office as well.
Mr. Chair. For whatever it's worth, and understand it's because of the times, you guys, I wish agencies like yours could get out there in the media. Somehow they always find the ones that that have a fund we didn't know about. But I had serious reservations last session about the publications person, and went forward thinking this is somebody who would help you catch up your backlog. And all of my decisions and budgets this session will be based on the understanding that there are people not going to be in nursing homes soon who are there today. And so that is the criteria that I use, people not getting medications, people not getting dialysis. So all of my decisions are based trying to resolve that issue. And with that, I would probably eliminate that publications person, knowing that they have done what they were there to do, and that, yes, we are likely to begin another backlog, but hopefully this will be through this in a couple of years or 3 years or whatever, and then we can go do it again and resolve the backlog. At least at that point, nobody's died because of it. And I would probably keep the staff attorney, because I don't know how you guys function without a staff attorney. And that may be my misunderstanding of things, and would keep the administrative assistant probably half-time. And that's for whatever it's worth, which may not be much.
Well, Senator, I share your concern. And one thing that I'm thinking about and talking with co-chairs and others about is that maybe we shouldn't be in a big hurry to pass out these budgets until we know what the human services budgets are doing and if they're able to resolve some of those issues.
Or what revenue's doing down at the other end of the hall.
Right. So. Any other comments? We do need to make some time for public comment here.
Yeah. I think the other side of this issue is that the way that we're really going to get out of this fix that we're in is getting people back to work, and that people being hung up in LUBA waiting for decisions to come out that are going to affect the way that things are going to be able to happen or not happen on the ground is also a consideration in the argument. And I think that if we're going to slow down the process of these appeals being resolved, that we have to consider that it does have real-world implications that are going to impact our ability to get out of the place that we're in.
Mr. Chair, that's why I wouldn't take the staff attorney. I would leave that. I don't think the publications person is going to slow us down in getting the appeals decided.
Okay. Any other comments? Thank you very much. Very nice presentation. I'd like to call on Ross Day. Welcome back, Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your record, Ross Day, Director of Legal Affairs for Oregonians in Action. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on behalf of LUBA's budget. In the interest of full disclosure, I will admit that we do have one active appeal pending before LUBA, so just to get that out on the record. But we're here today to testify, and I want everyone to take a deep breath in support of LUBA's budget. I have only been on the job there for about 4 weeks. I'm here in Dave Honeycutt's stead. He had a prior engagement he couldn't get out of. But at least for the last biennium, Dave reports that that LUBA has done an excellent job, and I would concur with everything that Mr. Holstrom had said regarding LUBA and their efforts. We certainly believe that they're, while we necessarily haven't agreed with all of their opinions, they have been reasoned and based on the law, and I think they should be commended for that as well. In terms of their budget and the potential reductions, I think Representative Morgan hit the nail on the head that if we slow down the process, understand what we're really doing, we're slowing down ability for people to get out and develop their property and use their property. That's really what we're doing. And property owners, when they have an appeal pending before anybody, whether it be LUBA, Circuit Court, Court of Appeals or Supreme Court, or in one of our cases the U.S. Supreme Court, they're reluctant to develop until they get a final decision. They don't want to have to either remove their development, stop their development, in one way, shape, or form. So when you're considering this budget, we'd urge you to consider that very important factor, that slowing down the appeals process at LUBA is could very well have unintended consequences, I think, in the long run. So with that, thank you very much, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions, committee? Thank you, Ross. For the rest of the committee, if you don't know, Ross was Roger Senator Byers' staff when he was a representative, and so we were next door to each other for.
I also worked for the majority office in the prior session, too, in the interest of full disclosure.
But I knew you first. So.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to give testimony today? If not, committee, before I hit the gavel, you do have your backup work for tomorrow before the George Commission. So take that with you and read it over.
And Mr. Chair, I also wanted to distribute to you some drafts of next week's agenda so you know what to expect.
Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing.